have something that helps people comply.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. Unfortunately, for the other callers who were waiting, we're out of time. Thank you for trying to call. And also, public advocate Jumaane Williams, thank you so much for joining us this evening on the WBAI Evening News.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate you and, of course, the listeners. Peace and blessings, love and light to everyone.
Okay. All right. So that wraps it up for tonight. And stay tuned. More great programs to come on WBAI 99.5 FM.
The previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio, and this is still WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. Extinction Rebellion is an international nonviolent direct action movement pressing for action on the climate emergency. This week, we have with us Shuka Bidarian. She is environmental correspondent for Marjan Television, a Farsi-language TV network based in London. In October 2021, she won the Alfredo Serkis Memorial Green Ring Award for her climate communication. Her most recent documentary film just premiered in early December 2021. It focuses on COP26 and the many political and activism dynamics around that event. Shuka, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to be here.
So we like to ask people from all around the world about how the climate crisis is affecting different places in the world. How is the climate crisis affecting Iran?
Well, I don't think there is a place on Earth where the impacts of climate change have not yet been seen or experienced. Iran, like many other parts of the world, has also seen some changes and been affected by extreme climate-related weather events, noticeable reduction in rainfall and changes in precipitation patterns, as well as an increase in temperature confirms the effects of climate change in the country.
Now, how extreme have the temperature changes been?
Well, we had up to 1.2 to 2 degrees, and this summer we had some of the worst heat waves, I would say, and obviously we have experienced the worst droughts in 50 years.
Well, you know, people in the West who read international news have probably heard about the drought, and we want you to tell us about that. But there must be things we haven't heard about as well from the Western press.
Well, we know that this man-made global warming pollution that we have been putting in our shell of atmosphere, you know, for the past 150 years or so has been affecting our natural weather events. And as a result, we are seeing these events happening more frequently and much worse than before. But we also know that climate change acts as a catalyst and is a threat multiplier. And what it means is that climate change takes a situation that already exists and exacerbates it. So this summer, as I mentioned, we experienced the worst drought in 50 years in Iran, and we are no strangers to droughts in this country. But what we are seeing now is longer, more frequent and severe droughts, although we can classify what we see in Iran mostly as what we call anthropogenic droughts. There is no doubt that the rising temperature has worsened the already critical situation in Iran. And to just explain that a bit further about the anthropogenic drought, what we are seeing in Iran is a result of decades of bad resource management, particularly water management. And the thirst for growth has led to excessive use of water resources. This has, of course, created multi-dimensional problems in the country. So when it comes to a country like Iran, we need to be very careful not to climatize everything, because this would just give the government another excuse, unfortunately, to blame everything on climate change instead of admitting what they have done for decades has made the situation we are in today more critical.
So an interesting almost dilemma methodologically in delineating which parts are global climate change of the problem and which parts are somewhat more locally generated by, for example, government mismanagement.
Absolutely. But we can see the impacts of climate change. It is working, as I mentioned, as a catalyst, and there is no doubt, and we can clearly see that in the country.
You mentioned water supply. What is the water supply situation in Iran now? Maybe it's different in different regions. Tell us about that. And also, what's going to happen with water in the years to come? Is there a clear trend in water supply direction going on?
Well, as you know, Iran is located in an arid and semi-arid region of the world. And when compared to many countries in other parts of the world, Iran is not a water-rich country, and its water availability is limited. Iran is now in what our Iranian water scientists call a state of water bankruptcy. Again, I repeat this because it is important for everyone to understand why Iran is struggling with water. Decades of managerial myopia and bad water governance have led to the overuse of surface water and over-abstraction of groundwater resources to a point where the country is water bankrupt. And what it means is that the situation, unfortunately, has passed a state of crisis, and much of the damage now will never be restored. So to look at it realistically, instead of looking for a quick techno fixes, which is unfortunately what the government of Iran has been doing, from dam building to now water transfer and desalination, we need to better manage and reduce the growing water demand and make effective use of the resources we have left. That would mean fundamental changes in our agricultural sector, which is responsible for more than 90% of the total water consumption in the country. And of course, investments in other sectors to create job opportunities for the less advantaged communities.
Is there a day-to-day shortage or a week-to-week shortage? Are there periods of time where you turn on the tap and there just isn't reliable water? What happens?
Yes, especially this summer because of the reduced rainfall and, as I mentioned, the worst drought that we have experienced in 50 years. We had water shortages across the country, people, you know, queuing up to try to get some water, just drinking water or, you know, water for essential users. And even now, we are in autumn, 2 months has almost passed. And again, we are still struggling. And most of the dams in Iran are nearly 40%, 40 to 50% short of water and nearly empty, basically.
That's extraordinary. Now, you mentioned bad water governance. What's behind this bad water governance? In other words, what makes the governance of the water in Iran so bad? How is it? Why is it so bad? And what's behind that?
That's actually an excellent question. I was going to get to it later on. I must mention that I'm not a water expert, but as a journalist and a person who is doing her studies in sustainable development, I have read so many scientific papers written by some of our brilliant water scientists and experts, Iranian scientists such as Kaveh Medani, Samaneh Ashraf, or Amir Aghakuchak, and so many more. And so the water governance, it all comes down to, unfortunately, the ideology of the regime, and which is mostly around food self-sufficiency. And because of that, we have seen in the past few decades that the agricultural sector has grown really fast and rapidly without any attention to crop patterns, just wanting to reach that food self-sufficiency. And, you know, in a country like Iran, where the climate is arid and semi-arid, most of the agriculture is taking place by irrigation. And so you can see how that is affecting our water resources, both surface and, unfortunately, our groundwater resources.
Food self-sufficiency, it makes me think in terms of the embargoes that Iran has faced. And so it sounds like to me that, and maybe I'm getting this wrong, the decision to make sure that those kinds of political decisions on a global scale, that Iran can survive those. Is that what you're, when you say food self-sufficiency, I know it's also about the environment, but are we also talking about the political environment?
It's all about wanting to be independent and not reliant on other countries or, you know, the global international community, I would say.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM New York with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. And we are speaking with Shuka Bedarian, the environmental correspondent for Marjan Television, discussing with us how the climate crisis is affecting Iran, what's already happening, and what to expect in the future.
Shuka, could we be looking at a large migration of Iranians? I mean, if we're talking about mass water shortages, could that happen in the years to come? Where will people go?
Well, unfortunately, we have already seen a sharp rise in migration from villages to big cities. Although there's no precise data to demonstrate how many percent of this migration is due to water-related and drought issues, but we know that many of the farmers in villages and countrysides had to leave their homes because they were no longer able to provide for their families. But the water-related issues aside, there was a research a while back indicating that many parts of Iran, unfortunately, will be uninhabitable in the next 20 years due to global warming and climate change. And so forced migration will be inevitable for some people living in certain areas in Iran, and obviously not only in Iran, but many parts of the world.
Can you talk about the political unrest from all these environmental and natural resource crises?
Well, as mentioned again earlier, the situation we are in today has not simply arisen out of thin air. The environmental degradation and the water bankruptcy situation in Iran is a result of decades of bad management, thirst for growth, and the ideology of becoming food self-sufficient after the revolution, as well as the rapid growth of population, as I mentioned. And as I said again, our Iranian water scientists have been warning us about this for years. And as usual, their warnings have been massively overlooked and ignored by the authorities and those in power. And that is why we are in the situation that we are today.
We read in the Western press that there have been widespread protests in recent years, partly drought prompted. How organized is the opposition? How stable is this regime? What do you think?
Well, as you may know, there is no freedom of speech in my country, and human rights are always violated in Iran. People are not allowed to express their opinions freely. And if they do, we have seen it in the past and even now with all the protests that are still happening, they get silenced. But I think there comes a point where we all think enough is enough. And we always say that oppression does not last.
So how does the Iranian government respond specifically to environmental activism?
Environmental activism, it's, again, movement like the environmental movements bring people together and unite communities. So this is something that an unpopular regime like the Islamic Republic of Iran fears and feels threatened by. So just to give you an example of how the regime tries to control basically everything is the way it controls its NGOs and how they are almost fully funded by the government and therefore are not as free as you would want them to be to have strong opinions on environmental issues. We still have a few of our conservationists in prison, unfortunately, accused of being spies. So as you can see, it is very difficult, and in a way, it is a challenge to have a high level of activism of sorts, in such situations. Having said that, I must say that that has not stopped Iranians. And because of Farsi-speaking media platforms outside of Iran, where people can actually freely criticize the wrongdoing of leaders and authorities, and of course, social media, there has been a growing awareness about the environmental issues.
And there's a Human Rights Watch report of jail of some of the people who you may have just been referring to that I saw. And I certainly don't know the truth of the circumstances and the allegations, but it looks to Human Rights Watch like these people were doing environmental activism, conservation related work, and were charged for whatever reason with spying. So, I see names like, which I'm going to pronounce as best I can, Taher Gadirian, Niloufar Behrani, Amir Hussein Kalegi, Usman Jokar, and several others who have been jailed potentially for many years for not entirely clear reasons. What's the motivation for jailing these people?
And again, obviously, when they decide to have people in prison, they always find allegations to accuse them of, the so-called crime or what they call or refer to as crime. So these people were out and about in the wild and in the protected areas, researching on our endangered Asiatic or Iranian cheetahs. And they have been doing an amazing work. Some of them are very well known in the world as well, like Niloufar Behrani. And it is really sad because of their work, obviously, they are to take pictures and, film and video, when observing the cheetahs in the wild. And this was just as an example, one of the accusations that you are spying, you're using your cameras, you're filming, why are you in an area close to one of our, one of the buildings that is of a high security and, accusations like that.
Iran is one of the biggest oil exporters in the world. As all the world knows, Extinction Rebellion likes to chant, "Keep it in the ground," at its protest, referring to oil and coal. Quite a sharp contradiction there. Is Iran seeking to diversify its economy? Is it ever going to manage to do this so that it's not so oil dependent? Or will they just carry on until every drop is gone and then collapse after that? What's going to happen long term?
Well, at the moment, we only have less than 1% of our total energy generated from renewable sources. Less than 1%. So the country is massively reliant on its fossil fuels and the so-called plans to increase the capacity for renewable energy generation have only been seen on paper, unfortunately.
The nuclear negotiations are climate relevant because Iran has offered to join the Paris Agreement if the U.S. returns to the treaty, and because nuclear energy would be a zero emission source if nuclear energy is really what Iran is after. Now, we could surely do an entire show just on this topic. What is your take on that whole situation?
Well, as you said, you mentioned if nuclear energy is really what Iran is after. And that is a very good point. Iran has announced that only if all sanctions are lifted, the country will join the Paris Agreement. I think this is yet another excuse for the regime to get their way and what they want.
Like other correspondents for Marjan Television, you're reporting on all of this from within the Iranian diaspora. You're not in Iran, as I understand it. Since you are critical of the Iranian government, it would be difficult for you to go to Iran. So sort of a meta question, but I think important. Can you comment on what the status is about reporting on something from a diasporic context?
Well, I think being a journalist trying to cover Iranian environmental issues is challenging, whether or not you're in the country. Well, for us outside the country, what we benefit from is the freedom of speech. And we can easily and freely criticize the wrongdoing of the leaders and emphasize on the environmental issues and the injustice that is happening now in the country and affecting millions of people and millions of Iranians. But I like to take this moment to also talk about the journalists in Iran, the environmental correspondents in Iran. I must say, in regards to some journalists and some activists in Iran who I collaborate with, I have so much respect for them because I can see how determined they are in getting the message out there, even though it's this could mean that they could end up having and causing them more problems. So it is very different for us who live outside of Iran. I can freely express my opinion on environmental issues, but the challenge is mostly for those trying to still get the message out there and raise awareness within the country.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM New York. You are listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. And this week, we are speaking with Shuka Bidaria, the environmental correspondent for Marjan Television, talking about reporting on environmental issues in Iran, talking about how the Iranian government treats environmental activists, in some cases with lengthy prison sentences, and talking about how the climate crisis affects Iran. And of course, by extension, the rest of the world.
Shuka, we're going to change gears a little bit and talk about your film. Now, your most recent film, which is in Farsi, so most of our listeners won't be able to benefit from it, but certainly many of them will. But by all means, tell us the title and how to find it.
Well, the good news is that we are looking into having an English version of this documentary. I have received a great deal of positive feedback from non-Farsi viewers. They are saying that even though the voiceovers are in Farsi, but because they are nicely spaced out among the English interviews and because of the visuals, it is still watchable for them. So this is, so I still encourage your listeners to also sneak a peek and have a look at the documentary. It is the first major documentary on climate change in Farsi, and it is called COP26 with Shuka. You can find it on Monato TV YouTube channel.
Now for the Tower Fund Drive. WBAI is doing a fundraising drive currently as we're recording this in December, and we encourage all of you to contribute. Their idea is to raise as much toward this year's rent as possible, so we have less fundraising to do later on. And these are basic costs: rent for the office and rent for the antenna that beams the programs over the radio waves and into your car or into your home, or if you have one of those portable radios, then into that box you're carrying around with you.
You can contribute to this Tower Fund Drive by going to WBAI.org. And there's a big banner right there on the homepage that says in bold letters, "Donate to Tower Fund." You can't miss it. So WBAI.org and click on Donate to Tower Fund. If you prefer to donate by phone, you can also call the WBAI call center at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. As you all probably know, this is a listener-supported station. This type of fundraising is essential to the station's existence. So donate today. Call 212-209-2950 or go to WBAI.org and click on Donate to Tower Fund. We and WBAI would really appreciate it. Thank you.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing. Tune into Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright. On Tuesday, January 4th at 9 p.m., we'll be joined by playwright, novelist, poet, publisher, professor, and America's most fearless satirist, Ishmael Reed, to discuss the new production of his play, The Slave Who Loved Caviar.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, cats don't drink coffee, do they?
If it's brewed with fish.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next meeting on Wednesday, January 12th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be the occasion of a delegates assembly to elect WBAI representatives to the Pacifica National Board. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, January 12th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service. The meeting, accessible to the public, includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. That's 929-205-6099. And enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. That's 922.457.2995. And as if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, 99.5. So it's 995.995.99. Do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but we sure hope that you do.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI.